This episode is brought to you by Ludwig Coffee, delivering exceptional specialty coffee to New Yorkers since 2018.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the good fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome food writer Yasmin Khan. In today's episode, we'll talk to Yasmin about migration food stories, her new book, Ripe Figs, and we'll hear Yasmin's Julia moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back. As always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. Before Julia settled into her famous kitchen in Cambridge, Massachusetts, her life was full of international travel and adventure. Her early married life to Paul Child was nomadic. There was little hardship involved, food was not scarce, and their security was assured. However, Julia was far away from home and her family. She was lucky enough to first land in France, where even in the wake of World War II, food was plentiful and appreciation for it deeply embedded in French culture. For the rest of her life, these experiences and memories stuck with Julia. Writing to her dear friend and Mastering the Art of French Cooking facilitator, Avis Devoto, Julia said, "How I love to come back to this sweet and natural France, this warmth, these wonderful smells, this graciousness and coziness and freedom of spirit." Someone who also deeply appreciates what travel, moving to other lands, and the connections we have to food from back home, and what we discover in new homelands, is Yasmin Khan. Yasmin is a food and travel writer, broadcaster, and human rights campaigner. Her work centers on the intersection of food, travel, and politics, notably challenging stereotypes about the Middle East through celebrating the region's beauty in contrast to its conflicts. She's appeared in prominent shows such as BBC's Newsnight and written for leading publications like The Guardian, Savoir, and Roads and Kingdom. Yasmin trained in law and ran international campaigns on poverty and human rights before transitioning to writing. She's the author of multi-award-winning cookbooks, The Saffron Tales, about Persian food, and Zaytoun, about Palestinian cooking. Yasmin joins us today to tell us what has drawn her to Eastern Mediterranean food, stories of displaced people, as well as about her newest cookbook, Ripe Figs, Recipes and Stories from Turkey, Greece, and Cyprus. Welcome to the podcast, Yasmin.
Hi, Todd. How you doing?
Well, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. My book came out in the US last week, so... yeah, I'm just doing what all writers enjoy, which is, you know, after years of working on a book, you finally get to speak to people about it. Although I am sad that we can't do this in Roberta's, you know, I love being in that studio. That's where a lot of the Heritage Radio stuff gets recorded, right? That's where I've been before.
Pre-pandemic, absolutely, yeah.
I know, in the before
although
times.
Our show was remote, so kind of used to that, but it is more fun to be present with the guests, but... We adapt. So yeah. Tell us, how did you get so specifically interested in the food and culture of the Eastern Mediterranean?
Well, many things, I think, brought me to write this book, Ripe Figs. So my background is that I'm of mixed heritage. I'm half Iranian and half Turkish. And, you know, my previous books are very much focused on Middle Eastern food. But I've always had a deep love of Turkish cuisine as well, which is just, of course, you know, a hop, skip and a jump along away mm-hmm. from, in terms of that region. And the area of London that I live in, and I've lived in for about 12 years, is called Hackney. And it's an area where historically there's been, over the last kind of 60 years, a lot of Cypriot, Greek and Turkish migration. So, you know, the streets where I live are lined with baklava stores or, you know, Turkish, you know, grill restaurants. You know, my local greengrocer is filled with, you know, crates of halloumi or marinated olives, you know, or bottles of pomegranate molasses and tahini. So, you know, my neighborhood is intrinsically Eastern Mediterranean. And, you know, in recent years, just I've really wanted to delve deep into celebrating that. So that's maybe the basis. But then on top of that, in recent years, as increasingly kind of I kind of watched the news reports coming out of the region, which has seen the biggest movement of people into Europe since the Second World War. About 5 million people have moved into that area, mainly remnants of, you know, the Syrian civil war, the wars on Iraq and Afghanistan. And I became increasingly moved, I think, by the stories of these refugees and migrants, and curious as to, you know, how this was changing a region, both in a practical, you know, sense, but also in a culinary sense. And so I guess those two things inspired me on my trips. You know, I love using food as a way of delving into broader social and political issues. And in my mind, there's probably no issue that's had kind of more political attention put on it than you know, borders and migration in recent years.
I think it would be helpful because I too live in North London, just northwest of you, where the same I've been marveling at the same influence of Turkish and Cypriot and sometimes Greek, although usually people are Cypriot and either Turkish or Greek Cypriots. And it, certainly to someone who isn't, the food has similarities or a lot of common dishes, but I would think to anyone who is Turkish or Greek or Cypriot and Cypriot Turkish or Cypriot Greek, they see them more distinctly. And I also thought it would be helpful if you could kind of give everyone the briefest history lesson of basically why what are distinct cultures and countries have this sharing of similar dishes.
Sure. Well, the history of Greece, Turkey, and Cyprus, and that whole Eastern Mediterranean region, you know, its history is one of borders being as fluid as they have been contested over several thousand millennia. Many of the big great empires of our civilization have you know, run through that region. You know, from the ancient Greeks, the Persians, the Romans, the Venetians, the Ottomans, who probably had like the biggest culinary influence. The Ottoman Empire had a particular emphasis on its kitchens and incredible, you know, culinary arts that came out of that. And as a result of these kind of melding of borders, and of course the geography of the region just being very similar, you know, that beautiful Mediterranean climate with fertile red soils and, you know, perfectly fit for olive trees and, you know, vineyards and things. So that is kind of historically why there are many similarities. And whilst, you know, there are many books that could be written about the specifics of each cuisine, what I wanted to do, which also fits in with my narrative of what I'm trying to explore in the book, I wanted to really zoom out and try and find similarities where perhaps some would like to only focus on differences. And I think there are many similarities in the food of that region, whether it's a particular love of grilling barbecued meat over hot coals, or the abundant use of olive oil, which is used as a seasoning as well as a cooking ingredient, or the exceptional dairy produce that exists, you know, the famous Greek yogurts and feta cheese, which have their equivalents in Turkey and Cyprus and are used liberally every day in as a side or in cooking. And a really rich array of vegetable-focused dishes, often served at room temperature, and a style of eating which we're all familiar with, you know, mezze, that beautiful selection of small plates served over several hours alongside often copious bottles of red wine and perhaps an anise-flavoured liquor like raki or ouzo. So there are many similarities, I feel, if you choose to look for them. And I think that that is applicable not just to food in the Eastern Mediterranean, but humans all over the world in general.
Well, I'm struck that by you're talking about a lot of things that are either native to or flourish in that geography. And of course, that kind of nature doesn't recognize artificial political borders. So I think that that's very, you know, telling. And you talk about in Ripe Figs about the political divide and how Cyprus as an island has been politically divided down the middle, but culturally it's harder to divide, right?
Absolutely. So for those who don't know, Cyprus is a beautiful Mediterranean island in the Mediterranean Sea. And it's south of Turkey, north of Egypt, to the west of Syria, Lebanon and Israel. And it used to be a British colony. And like many former British colonies, sadly, after the British left, kind of stoked up a little bit by the divide and rule tactics that the British tended to employ in a lot of places. And the island ended up in a civil war and since 1974 has been divided, Turkish Cypriot in the north and Greek Cypriot in the south. And there is a UN partition wall in the middle, you know, patrolled by UN soldiers and a green line, a kind of no man's land buffer zone as well. And that all sounds very, you know, stark and serious. And of course, in many ways, it really is. But what I wanted to do when I was there, and it's very easy to cross the border. And what I try and do in my work is I cook with people in their home kitchens. And I try, you know, during our time together at the kitchen table to explore kind of some of the issues that, that are relevant in a place. And for me, kind of time and time again, you know, whether I was cooking beautiful, you know, stuffed grape leaves filled with, you know, a tomato and rice filling, or I was eating gorgeous kind of tahini, sweet tahini buns that are a beautiful breakfast delicacy, you know, throughout the island. Or if I was eating some halloumi, the island's kind of most famous culinary export, which I don't know, the Cypriots just have so many wonderful ways for using it alongside mint, you know, such, you know, whether that's like halloumi and mint filled ravioli or, you know, halloumi and mint filled dumplings. But yeah, so, you know, I kept over and over again as I was crossing this border, seeing similarities at the kitchen table where political leaders, again, I think would too often like us to see difference. And it was really, again, fascinating for me to hear over and over again from the Cypriots I cooked with that, you know, they, many of them just wanted to identify as Cypriot as opposed to Greek Cypriot or Turkish Cypriot. And food, I think, was one of the ways in which the island could hold on to a collective identity.
And you also spent time in some of the Greek islands that have been front and center and most impacted by this migration story or forced migration in many ways of the Eastern Mediterranean, which has had a profound effect on European politics as well. But I was curious, in what you were just talking about, is that what kind of motivated you to tell the refugee stories, to break down the barriers of other or interlopers and look more at people who actually aren't as different as these political borders are imposing?
Absolutely. I mean, you really kind of hit the nail on the head there. You know, coming from the UK, you know, with Brexit and the fallout from that, so much of the debate around Brexit was around this fear of migrants. And it was shortly after, you know, we were seeing these people fleeing the Syrian civil war and a lot of xenophobia and racism was whipped up around that. And at the same time, you know, the last few years, well, you know, I think that the 4 years of the Trump administration also really focused on borders quite a lot, whether it was what was going on the Mexican border or whether it was, you know, things like the Muslim ban. And as someone who, you know, I'm British, you know, I was born in London, but as someone who's a second generation immigrant, I, you know, these stories weren't just abstract when I would read them on the news. They were very personal because, you know, my parents were economic migrants to the UK. But other family members have been political refugees. You know, Iran has been a very fraught place over the last 40 years. And, you know, I've had members of my family who've paid people smugglers to take them over the hills of Turkey, or other ones who've been able to kind of claim political asylum here in the UK. And had they not been able to, they would have felt, I mean, you know, who knows what they would have faced, but it certainly probably would have involved prison and potentially, you know, even worse actions. So yeah, it felt very personal to me, and I really wanted to see if I could, through a book, through food stories, try and change the narrative and perhaps build some empathy amongst people who perhaps, you know, don't know why people move, aren't quite so aware of the refugee and migrant story. And you know, some people might say, well, you know, I mean, a cookbook though, I mean, what's a cookbook going to do? But I actually think, you know, I was a human rights campaigner for almost a decade. Well, I guess I still am, but, you know, professionally I've worked for nonprofits for about a decade. And what I really realized during that time was that, you know, if you want to change a bit of legislation, or if you want to raise awareness about something, an issue, the first thing you have to do is build empathy between the subject matter you're talking about and, you know, someone sitting in an apartment in LA. And food is such a great connector in that respect. You know, it's a bit of a cliche, isn't it? But, you know, breaking bread is one of the oldest forms of human connection for a reason. And that's kind of my aim with this book, really. You know, a celebration of incredible recipes, a description of how the Eastern Mediterranean is changing with these new waves of migrants from Afghanistan and Yemen and Iraq and Iran, but also a book that can, yeah, through the food stories, hopefully build empathy.
Well, I think you've really achieved that. Before we talk more specifically in the second half about, you know, what's in the book and some of the delightful stories and food stories you tell, I wanted to ask you up front, and we've talked about this quite a bit already, about, you know, borders and migration. I think they've been a hot topic for a long time, but they've been particularly charged in recent years between Brexit, between the election in the U.S., the presidential election in the U.S., and between crises that have sort of died down, but were very volatile in the last few years in the Eastern Mediterranean, particularly with people dying trying to make these crossings. The reality is this kind of fluidity is here to stay. But I was curious, and people have been pushing back, right, about keeping the world from being interconnected. But my personal view is that is a losing battle. The world is interconnected and will grow more interconnected. But I was curious from your view, having delved into all of these connections, how do you see this influencing what we eat into the future?
I think it's a really good question. And there's so many parts to it. So I'm gonna start with maybe zooming out and then go into kind of how I think it will change our eating habits and practices. You know, one of the things that became really clear to me when I was researching the book was that there isn't actually a migrant or refugee crisis, even though I think I probably definitely put that in my book proposal, you know, for this book. Because what I've come to understand is that throughout the whole of human history, we have moved as a species for our survival. It's just an intrinsic pattern of what it means to be human, to travel and to move. I mean, you know, that's how the US was founded, right? It was through movement.
Yeah.
That's how, a lot of people kind of have a lot of, yeah, that bit can be edited out. Anyway.
No, I think that's a great point. You're saying that you're pointing out how recent these rigid constructs of borders and passports and all of this. I mean, I go back to my wife's grandfather was born in 1893. And to this day, he was born in the Pale of Russia, which is now Ukraine, but it was then not Ukraine. And he lived in Canada, he lived in the US, he lived in England, he lived in France. I'm always like, what passport did he have? And the whole family has no idea, because it was so much easier to just do that before. And I think people have forgotten, particularly if you've only been born under passport regimes, how new a phenomenon this is.
Absolutely right, Todd. I mean, that is exactly, you know, the point that I'm trying to make. You know, nation states are relatively new constructs, and it's important to see them as a construct. You know, it involves a bit of like, you know, getting your head around the fact that we've created something, but it isn't necessarily a natural order of things. And if we've created it, we can also move it. Before that, people used to move. There were empires. I mean, in the UK, the very first Alien Act, which is about kind of, you know, migrants, only came in around kind of 80 years ago. So this is a really relatively recent phenomenon. So adding on to that, the fact that the World Bank predicts that in the next, you know, couple of decades, due to climate change, we're going to see huge numbers of people moving. They predict that by 2050, we're going to have 150 million people who will be forcibly displaced by climate change. And this is a very live issue for us all, therefore, to be thinking about, you know, how in the 21st century can we update our concepts of borders and migration to enable people to live and move and work in peace and dignity? And, you know, building more fences or building more walls isn't actually going to be able to get us away from what the climate crisis is going to, you know, end up bringing into our world. So I just feel like these issues are so important and are going to become even more important. And of course, how is it going to affect how we eat? Well, you know, I think all over the world, we can see in every, you know, neighborhood. I might be in a particularly Eastern Mediterranean neighborhood now, but, you know, one of the great benefits of migration is the wonderful influence within kind of the culinary realm that come when people move, be that techniques, be that ingredients, be that stores opening up that specialize in particular products. And I think, again, that fluidity has always existed. And, you know, I, for one, certainly think it's something to be celebrated. You know, I think the kitchen table and our kitchen store cupboards are probably the place where we enjoy the benefits of migration the most.
Yeah, I mean, I see that for the people affected by that climate change, it will be the kind of suffering and hardship that people forcibly or feeling forced to migrate in the Eastern Mediterranean have felt, but then the net benefit of those that's often under-recognized by the people that they're joining is this diversity of experience that actually augments life. And I'm struck by that we need to go to break that, you know, you talked about halloumi cheese, because it's sort of like halloumi cheese is a vegan or vegetarian lunch dish is a London staple. It's is London as anything else, isn't it, nowadays? Almost as British as anything else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
all right.
And yeah. So, you know, food, I think, is a bit like a language, you know, it's constantly evolving. It is always representative, kind of the era that it exists in. And yeah, I love that about it, actually, that, you know, it's constantly changing. And that's as a result of, you know, external factors such as migration.
All right, we're going to be right back to talk more with Yasmin Khan and more specifically about her cookbook, Ripe Figs. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Ludwig Coffee. With over 100 years of coffee cultivation heritage in the family behind this company, Ludwig Coffee has been delivering exceptional specialty coffee to New Yorkers since 2018. Their network of small co-op and family-owned farms grants Ludwig Coffee the opportunity to select exceptionally unique green coffee, ready to roast in small batches in Brooklyn, New York. Splurging on the main ingredient is important. Shop for Ludwig Coffee at lifcmarketplace.com.
Welcome back. We're talking to food writer Yasmin Khan about her new book, Ripe Figs, recipes and stories from Turkey, Greece, and Cyprus. So Yasmin, we've talked a lot about migration and borders and the geopolitical landscape, and not as much about the most fun part, like what you actually ate and what you've actually put in the book. And the book is a really wonderful combination of travelogue and, you know, stories about migration that we've talked about. But it, of course, is full of wonderful recipes and mouthwatering dishes. And I thought maybe you could pick a couple out that for you are not just, you know, dishes that you enjoy, but also kind of exemplify the journey that you went on to create the book, but also the journey you're trying to bring your readers along with you.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's hard to choose because it was a very delicious journey. But what I've tried to do in the book is include recipes that I think really clearly reflect the specific and distinctive culinary traditions of Greece and Turkey and Cyprus, alongside kind of more modern interpretations of classic dishes, and in addition, kind of recipes that reflect the new wave of migration that are in there. So I'll just talk you through perhaps a few of them. When I was in Istanbul, which in my view is one of the world's best foodie cities, you know, you're just hard pressed to have a bad meal there. You know, I wanted to include, you know, because I'm a travel writer and this book is full of travel essays, I wanted to include recipes that would really transport you there. And for me, one of my favorite recipes in the book is something so simple. It's a grilled mackerel sandwich, which is served with a really punchy salad dressed with those classic Turkish ingredients of pomegranate molasses, pul biber pepper flakes, which you may also know as Aleppo pepper, that kind of sweet, fruity, very mild chili flake, and sumac, that gorgeous, astringent, tart berry that's ground into a powder. Now, you know, in Istanbul, if you're walking along, you know, the Bosphorus Strait, which is that beautiful bit of water that runs through the city, you know, there are fish stands lining the streets with men grilling mackerel and making these sandwiches. And yeah, the dish just transports you back there. And some of my other favorites in Istanbul were a hot yogurt soup, which is really common in Turkic cuisines, you know, where yogurt is cooked with like some chicken broth and then flavored with, and then it's got like some small bits of rice that are simmered in there to thicken it, and then flavored with lots of mint, dried mint, and kind of topped with a chili butter. Again, that those pul biber chili flakes are everywhere. And that was a recipe that I was taught how to make by a woman of Kurdish, Turkish origin. And we had this wonderful conversation about borders and identity, and then were just nourished by this gorgeous soup. A few other recipes, you know, from the Greek recipes in the book are some of the real classics that, you know, we all love, whether it's, you know, a beautiful lamb kleftiko, those slow-cooked, oven-baked lamb with lots of oregano and thyme, some things like tarama salata, which is that punchy cod's roe. Well, it can be any kind of fish roe, really, but I make mine with cod's roe dip. It was so much better than the pink stuff you get in tubs in supermarkets. When you make it from home, it's just so exceptional.
It doesn't end up pink by accident.
No, exactly. Although you can make it pink with a bit of beetroot juice, but that's a separate story.
I have to ask you, do you know where did this idea that it should be pink come from?
Do you know what? I don't know. That's such a good question, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe it's because fish eggs, like salmon eggs or something, do have that reddish color. So they were like kind of trying to match the idea of its origin, even though it doesn't end up.
Maybe, you know, when you get it in the region, or if you make my recipe, it's just like a beautiful pale, you know, just a pale kind of creamy colored dip. So I have no idea.
Yeah, naturally it's kind of, yeah, off-white, creamy in color.
Yeah.
But, and for our listeners who don't know, the other amazing thing, in addition to halloumi cheese, tarama salata, which most Americans only have plentiful if they live in a neighborhood that had significant Greek immigration. Whereas it's in every UK grocery store, high end to low end, right? It's a staple of British food, which I assume is also a product of significant migration to the UK. It's not native.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially in London. There are real pockets of the Greek community. I just love it. It's one of my earliest food memories actually, eating tiramisu salata, because it's such a unusual flavour. And I remember I was at my mum was studying her PhD, and we were visiting her professor, and I went along with her, and she gave me some brown bread, toasted brown bread, and some tiramisu salata topped on it. And I must have been about five, and I absolutely loved it. It's just, I love it was so pungent and intense, and yeah. And then onto the food of Cyprus, which is a wonderful mix of kind of Middle Eastern and Mediterranean flavors. And, you know, they seem to have like a special like skill for putting dried mint into almost everything that they make. So, you know, I've got beautiful recipes for like halloumi and mint muffins, stuffed, you know, vine leaves that are kind of filled with rice that's flecked with dried mint and tomatoes. So, you know, they're the traditional recipes from the region. But then I've also included some really great recipes such that are like things like Afghan recipes, because there were so many Afghani refugees when I was there in Lesbos. So there's a gorgeous braised kind of pumpkin kind of that's cooked with lots of garlic and ginger and topped with another kind of yogurt sauce, which is, you know, an Afghani inspired dish. Or there's a lovely pomegranate and sumac roasted chicken, which is inspired by the flavors of Syria. And a meal that I kind of ate a few times at a restaurant in Mytilene, the capital of the Greek island Lesbos, that was set up by a Syrian doctor who was there as a refugee and had been stuck on the island for a long time and therefore had made a restaurant. So, yeah, it's been lovely actually to be able to bring those other elements into a book, because, you know, just in the same way that if you were writing a book about British food, you'd have to reflect the migration into the UK, it's the same there. So I just wanted to include some Syrian and Afghani and Iranian recipes as well.
Wow, that's great. And that was just a mouth-watering. I hope everyone's eaten before listening, because if that won't make you hungry, I don't know what will.
I know, I'm actually thinking of going out to buy some tiramisu salata after this call, actually.
I know, and I get mine now from an Israeli deli, because it tastes better than what's in it. It's still pink, but it's...
I've never had an Israeli version. Is it...
I don't think it's Israeli. I think it's just, it's an Israeli deli and they're selling tiramisu salata because they're in London. But right, I think they make it themselves. And they told me their baker was, and he was something else Middle Eastern, but he may not make the tiramisu. But anyway, actually on that note, my next question was related, because I think I found such delight living in North London with the fact that I've learned, and particularly around me, which is really more Crouch End, is most of the shopkeepers are Cypriot, and sometimes they're Greek and sometimes they're Turkish. Actually, more often they're Greek Cypriots, I think. But, and then certainly in London more widely, there's a lot of Turkish people in the greengrocer business. And, you know, my instinct originally coming from the States is, oh, no, you trust a big supermarket and all of that. And who are these random stands? And then you find, well, actually, these random small storefronts have much better produce. And that comes from this cultural, or I've learned, this cultural appreciation for good food that Turkish and Cypriot people have, and Greek. But in our neck of the woods, it's mostly Turks and Cypriots. And they just weren't going to eat the rubbish from Tesco. And so they've built a whole niche kind of business around that in both green grocers, in importing specialty products, whether it's good tahini or pomegranate seeds or sumac, and then also in running wonderful restaurants that are based on the often simple food, but really high quality ingredients and freshness. And so I was curious, you know, especially people come to, you know, many people have been to London many times and might want to do something different than, you know, just go to the Shard and go around the London Eye and look at Westminster. So I was curious to get some of your recommendations for people who want to venture out of zone one on the tube, and where would you send them?
It's a very good question again. And you're so right. I feel so lucky to have this, incredible you know, abundance of food stores just on my doorstep where the produce is just so exceptional. And it's interesting, actually, because whenever I have friends come over from the States, you know, they always have their list of restaurants that they want to go to that they've read about, that, you know, the top 20 restaurants in London or whatever. And I always make them come to my neighborhood and take them to one of the Turkish Ocakbaşı restaurants, which are grill restaurants, which the area I live in, I mean, they're be like 30 within a 1 mile radius of my house, possibly more actually. That doesn't, I love, I mean, just, you can't have a bad meal here, but I particularly love Testi. I really like Mangal Too. You know, you can find both of those places really easy just by Googling them. They're kind of really well known to Londoners. But yeah, I really recommend getting
Mangal's the one that is makes the eater lists of best places a lot.
Oh, really? Great. I think so. Yeah, and I just really recommend coming up to Dalston, kind of walking up the streets towards Stoke Newington, and you will just be in a food lover's paradise. Get yourself some gozleme. You know, pick up some baklava. You know, there are speciality kind of pide stores and lahmacun, which are Turkish pizzas. It's a great place to come for Turkish breakfasts. And I do think that perhaps the Turks do the best breakfast in the world. I mean, the Turkish breakfast is this feast of small plates, you know, of you know, three or four different kinds of cheeses, you know, sliced cucumbers and tomatoes, some olives, you know, perhaps an egg dish. Well, there's always an egg dish. It could be a menemen, which is like a tomato scramble. It could be eggs, you know, in cooked, poached in yogurt with chili butter. There'll be jams such as like carrot jams, sour cherry jams. There'll be breads. You know, it's just a feast. I've probably only mentioned like half of the amount of things that you get on there. So yeah, come over to Hackney and Dalston. It's just, I think, one of the best foodie areas in the city.
And I think you write about in the book, and the part that I know, which is a bit north, is this area. It's really a road called Green Lanes, right? And
yes.
Green Lanes actually goes really far from Turnpike Lane, which is wood green, all the way down to where you are in Hackney, right? And so it's pretty massive distance that kind of has this just unbelievable offerings of food and restaurants and grocery. There's some other stuff too, but is that sort of, would you say just start at the bottom of Green Lanes and work your way up?
Yeah, so I live just off Green Lanes, right at the beginning of it by Newington Green. And yeah, as you said, Green Lanes it's a very historic road, actually, one of the oldest roads in London. And it's also one of the longest. It's 6.3 miles, which is a really long road to go through just one city. And as you pass through, you get different, you know, flavors of the Eastern Mediterranean. You know, where I am, it's particularly kind of Turkish, and kind of as you go a bit further up, it's more kind of Kurdish. Even a bit more further up, it's more Cypriot. And yeah, it's a great place to do your shopping.
Yeah, and I think it's a great place to get a version of multicultural London. And just Shepherd's Bush on the other side is another one that's like a whole other world. But for those, if you've maybe people get often as far as Islington and like Angel,
yeah.
If you just keep going, it keeps getting interesting. All right. After the break, we're going to hear Yasmin's Julia moment. Get in touch. Send us an email or a voice memo to contact@juliachildfoundation.org, or better yet, tweet us @JuliaChildJCF. Let us know what you think about today's show and share your ideas for future guests. Migration stories are also part of the American winemaking story. We'll explore how immigrant labor is a vital part of Santa Barbara winemaking at the kickoff of this year's Santa Barbara Culinary Experience. Join us May 21st for El Buen Equipo, It Takes a Village to Make Great Santa Barbara Wine. This virtual event will be hosted by Matt Kettman, an editor at Wine Enthusiast and the Santa Barbara Independent. It's free, and you can watch it from wherever you'll be on May 21st. Go to sbce.events to register. We'll be right back.
When you flip anything, you really You just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia Moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she might have inspired them in their career. Yasmin, what's your Julia moment?
Well, it's hard, isn't it, to pick a Julia moment? And I love that little clip that you shared because for me, I think Julia Child is such an incredible influence in so many ways. But I'll just pick two briefly. I think, you know, for me personally, her greatest contribution was just really being able to show that cooking is a pleasure and not a chore and something you can really enjoy. And that was certainly something that I've tried to, yeah, it's funny, I've just tried to convey that in my work whenever I'm running cooking classes or whether I'm kind of teaching, you know, doing televised work. But I think for me, it's probably the thing that I'm kind of smiling as I'm saying, actually thinking of my own memories, but one of the ways that she's influenced me the most is to actually give me the confidence around a flexibility in the kitchen. So, you know, I've definitely had occasions, you know, who hasn't when you've done TV work where you kind of, you know, a bit of food goes, well, I've definitely had moments where a bit of food has gone flying left, right and center, or, you know, a dish hasn't quite turned out the way I've wanted to and I've, you know, served it. And I think, you know, one of Julia's greatest gifts was to make one feel that that was okay. And now whenever I'm kind of, yeah, talking to people or doing something on TV or cooking even, I try and convey that sense that mistakes are okay and that food is something and cooking is something that we can enjoy and not get stressed by. And I think that, you know, I'm a home cook and I think, you know, the feedback I always get is that, you know, as a result of the way that I communicate things, I make people feel quite safe in the kitchen and you know, not worried about stressing, you know, getting something perfect. And I think Julia just embodied that, didn't she?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's definitely one of my favorite lessons from Julia is how that it's almost an ironic a combination, right? Because often instilling confidence kind of implies that you're going to do things right and well.
Yeah.
Whereas it's all, but she added that, like, well, confidence includes the ability to really mess up and to just deal with it and to realize that many things, most things are fixable.
Exactly on that point. And like, I remember once I was doing a supper club and I was making this Iranian like pomegranate and lentil soup, and you know what it's like, you've got a lot of stuff going on, the soup slightly caught at the bottom and it burnt, and we were all just stood there being like, oh no, what do we do? And I was like, it's fine, we'll just call it a smoky, you know, lentil soup, and plus it's fine, you know. And just, but it was that element, I think Julia gave people the confidence to be able to just go, hey, it's just food and we can just rectify it or we can do it a different way. And you know, it's just about being able to enjoy the pleasure that we get from food.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, thank you for your Julia moment, and thank you for your delightful book, Ripe Figs, that I think both brings the joy and reminds us of, you know, how important it is to understand migration and people who are migrants for a variety of reasons with a lot more compassion and insight than fear, and to do that through food and the wonderful meldings of food that it produces. So thanks for joining us, Yasmin.
Thanks so much for having me on.
A pleasure. Thanks everyone for listening. The book is Ripe Figs, Recipes and Stories from Turkey, Greece, and Cyprus by Yasmin Khan, with photographs by Matt Russell. It's out now from W.W. Norton & Company. Ask or search for it at your favorite bookseller. If you want to keep up with Yasmin's travels, it's at Yasmin Khan Stories on Instagram and at Yasmin_Khan, K-H-A-N, on Twitter. For more from the Foundation, make sure you're following at Julia Child on Facebook and at Julia Child Foundation on Instagram. It's at Julia Child JCF and I'm at T. Shulkin on Twitter. Follow at SB Culinary Experience on Instagram for the latest updates on this year's events, both virtual and in person. The Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at WGBH. Thanks, as always, to my co-producer of the Foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network today, it's Matt Patterson. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Valtorni. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, with downloads available soon after wherever you find your podcasts. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter. Our handle is @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.